A page out of Daddy's Playbook, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. North Korea's Kim Jong-il once invited Bill Clinton for talks in Pyongyang. Now his son Kim Jong-un is playing the same game with President Trump.
It's very unlikely that Kim just woke up on New Year's Day, had a sudden change of heart, and decided to be a nice guy going forward.
Plus, a Saudi princess says reforms in the kingdom are moving at the right pace.
We always would rather slow down a little bit and include a majority versus isolate. Because if you isolate people, that's what causes instability and anger.
And we hear about the deadliest female sniper in history.
What she was interested in was doing her job and killing Nazis and driving them from her land. That was what she cared about.
That's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for being here this Friday. Be cautious, but go for it. That's kind of the takeaway from our guests on the show today on this big news that President Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un have agreed to meet and talk. But it's not a done deal. Less than 24 hours after the news, the White House cautioned this afternoon that that meeting will not happen unless Trump sees concrete steps taken by North Korea. Still, if they do take place, what can we expect from these unexpected talks? Let's hear first from Sung Yun Lee. He's a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, and he says he's seen this sort of thing before.
Well, Kim Jong-un is taking a page out of his daddy's playbook in 2000. Kim Jong-il, in 2000, held the first ever inter-Korean summit and also pocketed $500 million South Korea sent Kim Jong-il into his secret account, $500 million as an admission fee for the South Korean president's visit to Pyongyang in June. And after having softened up South Korea, Kim Jong-il turned his eyes to taming the United States. For the first time, North Korea sent a special envoy to Washington, Vice Marshal Cho Myung-rok, who met with President Bill Clinton and conveyed to Clinton his boss's invitation to Pyongyang. Clinton was amenable to it, sent his Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, just 3 weeks after that visit by the North Korean envoy. And there was Madeleine Albright toasting Kim Jong-il in late October. And Clinton would have gone. He was preparing for that visit had it not been for the funny, the weird happenings in the wake of the election, the Al Gore, George W. Bush vote recount fiasco, and time simply ran out. So it's very unlikely that Kim just woke up on New Year's Day, had a sudden change of heart, and decided to be a nice guy going forward. Far more likely is the fact that he's been planning for this all along after that triumphant ballistic year that he had in 2017. It's now time to click on the charm offensive, get South Korea to take the lead in diluting, weakening sanctions against the Kim regime, and to have the U.S. come on board.
If I read between the lines of your comments, it sounds like you are suspicious of Kim Jong-un's motives here.
Well, I mean, we've seen this play out before several times. Whenever there is even the slightest hint of rapprochement, we grow excited, we have unrealistic expectations. I'm not saying the U.S. should never talk to North Korea, certainly not. But there are many traps strewn down the path to Pyongyang in that North Korea will seek concessions. And along the way, the U.S. will have to make some concessions, relaxing sanctions and so on, for this meeting to actually happen.
What is the minimum result you'd want to see in order for this meeting not to be a bunch of optimistic propaganda or even a total washout?
Well, we have set the bar pretty low. North Korea has successfully conditioned us to do that. And you'll notice what Kim Jong-un purportedly said, that in the meantime, he would not conduct any more ballistic missile or nuclear tests, and that he would be amenable to talking about denuclearization. All these sound like a dramatic concession, but they're not. Basically, Kim Jong-un is saying, I will henceforth commit no more crimes. I will not do more illegal things. These activities are banned by more than 10 UN Security Council resolutions. So by the mere utterance of abstinence on illegal activities is no concession at all. So Kim Jong-un will probably paint the Trump administration further into a corner as a petulant party, use that as an excuse to do another provocation he would have done anyway. And unless Trump is really willing to make more concessions, Kim will refuse to meet Trump.
So if we're to believe the statements that this meeting could happen before May, would you suggest making it happen sooner rather than later to keep up momentum? Or does this need to be thought through really carefully, maybe even pushing it past May, including, you know, staffing up quickly the East Asia desk at the State Department, getting a U.S. ambassador in Seoul, which we don't have, somebody who's versed in Korean politics and diplomacy, and I don't know, maybe even somebody who speaks Korean?
A summit meeting is very different from, a blind date. You have to eliminate every element of spontaneity. All agreements have to be reached before the actual face-to-face meeting. I don't see how the U.S. would benefit in any way by rushing through the schedule and planning for the summit in May. Maybe later down the road, yes, but I think it's too rushed. It's risky. And again, North Korea could just walk away from this.
We know that it's very hard to understand what's going on in Kim's head, maybe just as hard to understand where Trump is coming from. But the fact is, this is unprecedented, and there's never been a meeting between a sitting U.S. president and a North Korean leader. So just assess for us the significance of this moment.
Well, it could be a moment to remember in a positive light if Trump just looks at Kim right in the eye and tells him, Mr. Kim, tear down the walls of your horrific gulags. Even if Kim doesn't oblige, it could be remembered as a symbolic moment. But far more likely is the dramatic summit meeting and pageantry and banquets and bonhomie being remembered years down the road as another moment of shame, another ignoble, embarrassing moment in the 3-decades-long record of utter futility when it comes to diplomacy vis-a-vis North Korea.
Sung-Yoon Lee, professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So a skeptical view there of the planned Trump-Kim summit. Let's get another take now from Isaac Stonefish. We often turn to Isaac for analysis on North Korea. And he noticed something yesterday when South Korea's national security advisor spoke to reporters after his meeting with President Trump at the White House.
Besides the message that Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un had agreed to meet, the other thing was the flattery. It sort of was an instinct that the South Korean national security advisor needed to praise Trump for his policies and give Trump credit for putting together an excellent diplomatic solution.
Yeah, I mean, the quote was, I express President Moon Jae-in's personal gratitude for President Trump's leadership. That's kind of a dramatic statement.
It's very striking. Just striking because it's not something that foreign leaders generally say to American presidents.
What is that praise about, do you think?
I think that world leaders understand Trump's need for flattery and praise and understand that that's a great way to get what they want out of Donald Trump. When Trump went to Saudi Arabia in May, they projected a massive image of his face onto the Ritz-Carlton. And Polish politicians, when Trump went to Warsaw, bust in fans just so he felt like he was at a rally. We've certainly seen a lot of it from Asian leaders, from the state visit plus that Trump received when he visited China in November. We've seen it from people all around the world.
Yeah, so South Korea, clearly not the only country taking this approach to Trump. Do you see this as kind of a calculated approach to Trump?
I think it is definitely a calculated approach. I think world leaders, especially the ones who are slightly more disciplined than our own president, understand that flattery will get you everywhere. And that by making Trump feel really important and making him feel like he's the one that matters, that they will better serve their own interests and the interests of their country.
I mean, it's interesting, though, like solid traditional allies of the U.S., like the U.K. or Germany, they are not taking this approach. In fact, they've insulted Trump on occasion.
That's a good point. I think a lot of that plays into different interests and domestic considerations. South Korea, for example, needs Trump a lot more than Trump needs South Korea.
Mm.
And Saudi Arabia, being a monarchy and a very repressive place, doesn't need to listen to its citizens the way that Germany and the UK do. And I think that's very calculated.
How much time do you think analysts in these countries have spent just kind of analyzing Trump?
We know that the Japanese government hired a psychologist to profile him
very,
very early on and to try to understand how his mind works. And I got to say, I think they spend a lot of time on this, and I think it's an investment well spent.
You know, a lot of people have noted that Trump and Kim Jong-un can be pretty similar. They've got this fiery rhetoric, even their emphasis on loyalty. So if they do end up meeting in May or earlier, how do you think that's going to go? Could they come away having a real discussion, maybe even liking each other? Are they too similar? Or maybe we're getting this all wrong.
And I would love to be in the room and see how that dynamic plays out. I think the two men are similar in their sense of importance. And I think they also do both believe sort of this opposite of what Roosevelt did, you know, speak softly and carry a big stick. They're very into bluster and not necessarily backing up that bluster with action, but bluster for bluster's sake. Whether the two men will have any personal chemistry, it's really difficult to say. Dennis Rodman is probably, this is a crazy thing to say, but Dennis Rodman's probably the person best suited to answer that question because he's the only person we know of who's met Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un and has a surprisingly close relationship with both of those men.
You know, you just predicted my next question because I can't believe I was going to ask it, but are there lessons from Dennis Rodman that Trump could learn from?
I'm sure there are. I think what Trump has to do differently from Rodman is Rodman got a lot of flack for the positive things and somewhat inaccurate things he said about North Korea publicly. And I think it's very important for what Trump says to Kim Jong-un privately and what he says to him publicly to be quite different. Rodman was way too positive about Kim Jong-un and about North Korea, one of the world's worst dictatorships publicly, and that discredited him. So I think Trump has to be careful about saying wonderful things publicly and keep his fulsome praise to private meetings.
International affairs analyst Isaac Stonefish, thanks very much for walking us through this.
Thank you, Marco.
Now for a quick note on a high-level diplomatic meeting that's happening right now. A delegation from Saudi Arabia is currently visiting Britain. It includes Princess Rima Al Saud, the most senior woman in the Saudi royal family. She sat down with my BBC colleague Lise Doucette to talk about what the kingdom is doing for women.
If you look at the evolution for women across any society, it always began with expanding the educational opportunities. But it's one thing to be educated and another thing to have a job. And so we educated all of these women, but then the job opportunities didn't expand in order to allow that kind of force to come in. But now that the opportunity is, our women don't see a job too big or too small.
And yet, in a country with a guardianship system, no matter what their qualities and qualifications are, they need to ask a male guardian to travel, to get a passport, to work, to get out of prison if they happen to end up there.
Within the guardianship laws, today a woman does not need a man's permission to have any government service, which means in order to get her passport, she doesn't need a man's permission. In order to get an ID card, she doesn't need to get a man's permission to go to school, to have medical care. All of the things that have been previously addressed where women had an obstacle and needed a man's care or guidance in order to have the permissions don't actually exist today. Travel, for sure, and certainly still does exist, and I would say is the next bastion that we must, you know, work towards.
What about the men, the conservative men? Your relative, the Crown Prince, mm-hmm. Mohammed bin Salman, mm-hmm. has been encouraging, cajoling, convincing the really conservative clerics to allow cinemas, to allow women to drive, but the job is not done. And Saudis I speak to worry that there's still a lot of Saudis who aren't happy with these moves to open up, to give women more freedom. Do you worry about that, that there could be a backlash somewhere, sometime?
I look at every situation and say, with the decision that we're making, with the program that we'd like to implement, are we isolating a majority or are we including a majority? And we always would rather slow down a little bit and include a majority versus isolate. And there's a reason. Because if you isolate people, you begin to operate towards a minority. And that's what causes instability and anger.
Princess Rima Al Saud of the Saudi royal family speaking there with the BBC's Lise Doucette. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Yesterday, as you know, is International Women's Day, and all of March is Women's History Month. So we're going to combine the two with this next story. It's about a powerful woman who changed history. Lyudmila Pavlichenko was her name, a divorced single mother and factory worker who became a professor of history in the Soviet Union, and she was a world-famous war hero. You may not have heard of her, but Woody Guthrie definitely had.
Miss Pavlichenko, well known to fame. Russia's your country, fighting's your game. world will always love you for all time to come. 300 Nazis felled by your gun.
300 Nazis felled by your gun. Ludmila Pavlichenko was the deadliest female sniper in history. Woody was off by 9. Her confirmed kills actually number 309. Ukrainian-American writer Natalia Antonova grew up listening to her grandfather telling stories about Ludmila Pavlichenko. So was she kind of a role model for you, Natalia?
I think that he really wanted me to have a kind of role model that was strong. He was a Soviet major general. He was also a World War II combat veteran. And he and Ludmila were contemporaries. I don't know if they ever met because my grandfather was one of those men of that generation that, you know, kept a lot of secrets, wasn't always upfront about, you know, his history in the armed forces for various reasons, you know, both professional and psychological. But he definitely, you know, before he died, he was visiting us in the United States after we moved before he died. And we had those conversations with him then, actually, in Charlotte, and where I grew up, in the house where I grew up. And I have never forgotten them. And I think whenever International Women's Day rolls around now, I remember those conversations that we had about this woman and how remarkable she was.
So your grandfather admired her. Do you recall when you first really understood kind of the impact of her whole story?
Well, I mean, I think I really understood it when I grew up. Because one of the things he told me about her, and once again, being her contemporary, also serving in the armed forces and, you know, having access to a lot of information because of his high rank, he always told me that he used her as an example of, you know, the kind of woman who's very successful, who intimidates men. Because we have, like, there's been some debunking of Pavlichenko as a Soviet myth. You know, there's inconsistencies in her accounts have been pointed out. Some critics have said, well, look, you know, this woman was probably just used as a propaganda tool and as, you know, the face of the Soviet war effort. And, you know, she really didn't kill those people. But the thing that my grandfather told me is that he said that, yes, the rumor that she was just like a propaganda figure and that she wasn't real and that she was a myth, the rumor actually originated within the Soviet armed forces, because there was a lot of resentment of this woman amongst her male comrades. And it didn't just boil down to the fact that she was a very good sniper. It also boiled down to the fact that she was, she was very free. Mm. She dated men of lower rank, which was just not something she was supposed to do. And she regularly rejected officers, especially like high ranking officers, because, the way he put it, and I really didn't understand it as much as a child. I went back to it later as a grown woman and I saw what he meant. He was saying, she just really didn't want a man to own her, and a high ranking officer would mean that she was owned in a way that she didn't want to deal with. And that bred resentment among her comrades. And that's where it started, this idea that she was a fake. Now, are there inconsistencies in her account? Sure. Like, was it really 309? And so my grandfather told me, what he said to me, and I remember this very well, it was a conversation we had in our living room, like one dark, stormy night in Charlotte, North Carolina. He said, people will tell you, you will go out into the world and people will tell you that, you know, this girl was a myth. But, you know, he said, I've read about her. I've read the stuff that no one gets to read. She's not a myth. She's real. And like, you should remember that. And you should remember that men will occasionally resent you, you know, for being successful. He just wanted to impart that lesson on me. And I only really understood it when I got older, of course. But I do remember that conversation. And I think it was very meaningful and profound in many ways.
So she gets wounded several times. And then the last time after those 309 kills, they didn't send her back to the front. And she's sent on a propaganda tour to the West. Here's a clip of her speaking in New York City.
Я хочу сказать вам, что мы победим. Что нет такой силы, которая могла бы помешать.
So, Natalia, what is she saying?
Well, first of all, she's speaking with a very distinct Ukrainian accent. And she's a very, you can tell that she's like a military person because she's very like, doesn't care about being charming. She's forceful. And she's saying that I want to tell you that we will win, that there is no force out there that can stop us.
So here in the U.S., she was actually the first Soviet citizen to be received at the White House. And she actually became pretty close to First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, right?
Well, I think it's two strong women met each other and really just kind of got each other. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
So we should really remember the historic context here. This is 1942 that she came to the U.S. She toured the U.S. with Eleanor Roosevelt, but this wasn't like some Soviet sniper roadshow. There was actually a very real purpose to her visit, right?
Yeah, well, she wanted the U.S. to help out. She was, I think at one point she said, you know, look at me. I'm a young woman. Look at all the people I've killed. Are you tired of hiding behind my back? Which is just like, it's the kind of thing that gets men very riled up when a woman says that. But you know what? It needed to be said at that point in history.
So how the American press treated her kind of echoes the way women politicians are reported on today. It's kind of like dress and appearance first, policy later. How did she react to that?
Well, she made fun of it. I think she thought it was really funny. And she just, you know, she had been through a lot of trauma, severe trauma. And her lover, the man that she wanted to marry, I think, I don't know if they actually had the chance to marry or they were just engaged, but he was actually wounded in front of her eyes and she dragged him back by herself, but he died anyway.
Wow.
And, you know, as somebody who goes through all that and then is told, oh, hey, but why don't you look pretty for me? Like, they're not going to have any patience for it. I do also know, I think I recall from one article I read that, you know, Americans had their suspicions about her talents because, like, she wouldn't really demonstrate them while she was on tour at various points.
What, they were hoping that she'd pull out a rifle and, like, shoot a target or something?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the guys that was there with her on the trip, one of the Russian military guys, he did it. But the thing we have to remember also, she had severe post-traumatic stress at that point.
Yeah.
And for when you're at that point, you're not going to be like a show monkey. You're not going to do tricks for people. And that was the other thing. I kind of recall that I had that conversation with my granddad, too, is that she was not, you know, she wasn't going to like jump through hoops like a circus animal for anybody. What she did, what she was interested in was doing her job and killing Nazis and driving them from her land. That was what she cared about. She was a harsh person in that sense. But, you know, I also think that, like, looking back on her life and what she did and how she didn't break throughout it all, I sincerely, tremendously admire that. And I, you know, I hope more women get to find out about her and see that she was actually a pretty cool person.
Writer Natalia Antonova telling us about Ludmila Pavlichenko, mother, historian, sniper. Natalia, thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Texas is home to a lot of immigrants, documented and undocumented. So support for DACA is pretty much a lock, right?
As someone whose family waited in line to get citizenship, get naturalized, all the rest of it, I have always been opposed to letting illegal immigrants have a free pass.
DACA in a red state, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You've probably heard the news. The Trump administration is taking its fight against California's so-called sanctuary laws to court. The state recently passed legislation that limits when and how local law enforcement can cooperate with federal immigration officials, legislation that Attorney General Jeff Sessions laid into when he visited California this week.
We are going to fight these irrational, unfair, unconstitutional policies.
That's Sessions announcing the Justice Department's lawsuit against California. He was speaking at an event for law enforcement officers in Sacramento.
We are fighting to make your job safe. We are fighting to help you reduce crime in America, not increase it. We are fighting for a lawful system of immigration. And we intend to win this fight.
For more on this, I'm joined by Monica Campbell. She's the World's Global Nation editor. So what's at stake here with this lawsuit, Monica?
Well, California has been consistently challenging the Trump administration on immigration. Now the Trump administration is hitting California hard with this lawsuit, saying, you know, enough with these sanctuary-style laws. They certainly don't want other states to go as boldly as California has been on these types of laws. So there's a lot at stake. Ultimately, it's whether Trump will see his immigration agenda complicated as it is being complicated in California.
I mean, California, it seems, is really primed for a fight, but we are still seeing more immigrants arrested in California, and ICE agents are auditing businesses asking for employees' papers. Tell us what you've been seeing, and based on your reporting, what are the implications with all this?
Well, at the community level, there's a lot more organization. You have people have set up neighborhood watch style networks so people can text or call in if they see an ICE van or agents in the area. And those networks are becoming really active right now. But I also went to a more rural part of California where there is a large undocumented immigrant population. I met a farmer there. His name is Patrick Vincent Ricciuti. And in some ways, he represents where we might be going with all of this, what happens if this crackdown continues. And he used to grow stone fruit, so peaches, and his business was audited by immigration agents, ICE, years ago under Obama. And he had to lay off a lot of his workforce, and he changed his business to olive oil, which he says is less labor intense and it's more mechanized.
So Patrick changed his business to rely less on manual workers, immigrants, undocumented workers. Was that the idea?
Right. But he still subcontracts out workers for the harvest when he needs them. And what he's done is he hires those seasonal workers through somebody else. And here's what he said about that.
We just hire the contractor. It's not our responsibility to verify. We don't know what the labor contractor's, you know, obligations are and how they do their checking. It's all on them.
What is his take on the Trump administration suing California over these sanctuary-style laws?
Well, he's a longtime Republican. He voted for Trump, but he also understands why California is pushing back. Ultimately, he believes that Trump is doing well in terms of emphasizing stronger border security and trying to stop more immigration. But he's also really anxious for this big fix, and perhaps he says Trump will force that fix. Right now, his main worry is that so long as this battle is going on, that people like him, employers, along with people and workers, are being squeezed. And he's worried that farmers are going to be worried about hiring people while looking over their shoulder for ICE, or that people may not want to show up to work. They may start going back to their home countries, and that things could get pretty dire. And this is what he said.
This state and the other states would be shut down, and the crops would rot in the fields, would not get harvested, would not get planted. They haven't found a machine yet to pick a strawberry. They haven't found a machine yet to pick a table grape, okay? But it's going to come, and it's going to be at a sacrifice of higher cost to the consumer and less availability of quality.
Monica, it strikes me that this lawsuit could go on for a while and tie up the lives of a lot of people.
Absolutely. And I mean, in the Central Valley of California, Marco, you know, what often people, they call it the breadbasket of America, you have one of the largest undocumented populations in America living there. And you have people wanting to work, and you have farmers wanting to hire them. And ICE is increasing its operations in this part of the state, especially, you know, going to the farms and saying, hand over your papers of your employees. We need to check these people out. And what's going to happen? I mean, if you're a farmer like this guy, he's actually, you know, he's moving to an industry, olive oil, that requires fewer hands. So are we going to see basically a complete transformation of our agricultural system here in California, people going to crops that don't require as many people, that can be automated? And that's what he was implying.
The World's Monica Campbell with our weekly immigration check-in. Thanks very much, Monica.
You're welcome, Marco.
Meanwhile, it's still not clear what's going to happen with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. President Trump had decided to phase it out. Then the federal courts intervened, allowing hundreds of thousands of DACA recipients to renew their status. And Congress so far has failed to find a solution. My WGBH colleague Kirk Carapeza recently visited a college in Texas that enrolls about 200 DACA students. He found some students there who don't support the program.
All right, guys, I'm just going to go ahead and start now.
On campus at the University of Texas at El Paso, the college Republicans are holding their monthly meeting, brainstorming questions for a congressional candidates debate.
If not a wall, how would you secure our borders?
No, not my chair.
Oscar Sanchez, a junior, leads the student Republican group.
Who'd you vote for in 16?
For president? Donald J. Trump.
And like Trump, the 20-year-old thinks giving DACA recipients legal status undermines immigration law.
It's not fair for other immigrants, like my parents, for example.
His parents arrived from Mexico legally more than 30 years ago, hoping to get ahead.
My mom being from right here, Juarez, right across the border, and my dad from Chihuahua, which is like 4 or 5 hours away from here. He works in manufacturing. He just worked his way up and ended up getting good salaries as the older he got.
While some polls show more than 90% of Latinos in the U.S. support DACA, a statewide poll in Texas found 24% of Latinos want to end it. That includes sophomore Ana Cepeda, also at UT El Paso. She's 19 and says she's never had a close friend who's been undocumented, but does remember that at least one of her high school classmates didn't have papers.
She brought a lot to the school community, and it was really nice to have her. Very bright girl, and I think if anything, she brought competition in a positive way.
So you don't feel like the 10,000 dreamers who are here in El Paso are limiting your opportunity at all as a student?
No. I see that most of them are taking jobs that we have a shortage of people who would take them.
She says, though, that she didn't agree with DACA from the get-go and doesn't believe they should be offered a path to citizenship now. It rewards lawbreakers, she says. Peter Leyva agrees. He's 23 in his final year at college, and he was at the student Republican meeting, too, wearing a Make America Great Again t-shirt.
As someone whose family waited in line to get citizenship, get naturalized, all the rest of it, I have always been opposed to letting illegal immigrants have a free pass.
Still, Leyva doesn't blame any of his classmates who entered the U.S. illegally as children.
I blame the parents. You know, obviously the parents brought the kids here.
He also objects to private donors giving scholarships to DACA students.
You don't see those same things for poor working class white people.
While DACA students can receive state and college financial aid, they are not eligible for federal grants for low-income students. 6 years ago, after President Obama established DACA, administrators at UT El Paso encouraged undocumented students to come forward to try for scholarships. Now the university is facing harsh criticism for doing that.
This era has really challenged educators.
Katie McCory-Andalis is the dean of students at the university. She says administrators are expected to support all students and build bridges between them.
We have some of our students who are Dreamers, DACA recipients, who have decided to come out and be very public about their status. There are several others who absolutely have not. So I have shared with students to tell them they are among you. And that's ultimately our job as educators, to help them understand who they are as individuals and what it means to be a global citizen.
Global citizens living, working, and studying on the U.S.-Mexico border in the age of Trump. For The World, Kirk Carapeza, El Paso, Texas.
The Winter Paralympics got underway today in South Korea. This time, the two Koreas did not march in together for the opening ceremony. Still, today was significant because it was the first time for North Korea at the Winter Paralympics. The South made its debut back in 1992 in Albertville, France. Reporters Jason Strother tracked down one of those first South Korean Paralympians in Seoul.
Yu In-sheek's shop is filled with motorized wheelchairs in various states of disrepair. He fixes these, as well as scooters and other orthopedic equipment for persons with disabilities. The 55-year-old also makes adaptive sports gear, like outriggers, skis for people who don't have full use of their legs. He brings out the pair he uses when he hits the slopes. When Yu was a teenager, his right leg had to be amputated from the knee down due to a tractor accident. He says it crushed his dream of becoming a career soldier in South Korea's military, like his dad. But Yu says sports, especially skiing, gave him back his confidence, though it didn't come easy.
그러니까 이제 이거 다리 벗고 그 눈에
He says when he went skiing, he'd take off his prosthetic leg and leave it at the bottom of the mountain along with other people's ski bags. It scared children, and he was asked to wrap it up in a plastic bag. One time, a janitor threw it away. Yu says he asked the ski patrol for help getting it back, and the cleaning crew scolded him for just leaving his leg around like that. That was an accident, but Yu says other times, back in the 80s, he felt like he wasn't welcome on the mountain at all.
리프트 5인승에 쫙 서 있어요.
I'd take a five-person chairlift that the ski patrol would use, but once they saw my missing leg, he says, they wouldn't even sit next to me. They'd say, oh, I'm sorry. I guess they felt I was bad luck. I wanted to earn their respect, so I started training more. Yeah, they hurt me, but it pushed me to work harder. All that training paid off, and not just in skiing. You qualified as a power lifter for the 1988 Summer Paralympics in Seoul. Yu says he looked forward to representing his country in the Winter Games as well, but South Korea had never sent athletes to those Paralympics before. Then, in 1992, Yu got his shot in Albertville. He and another South Korean skier qualified for the downhill race. I ask Yu how it went.
가슴에 한이 많죠.
I still feel bad about it, he says. We weren't prepared. I didn't even have the right skis for the downhill. I felt athletes from other countries were just laughing at us. We'd flown in the night before and only had 3 hours of sleep ahead of the competition. But at least I did better than the Japanese skiers. Yu went on to compete again in Lillehammer and Nagano. And now, nearly three decades after his Winter Games debut, 36 South Korean Paralympians will be competing in Pyeongchang. I caught up with Minbyung Sok at a gym for the elderly and persons with disabilities in Seoul. He's an alternate on South Korea's men's wheelchair curling team. Min says he's looking forward to cheering on his teammates, and he hopes others will too.
예, 그 국내에서 패럴림픽이 열리면서
He says most South Koreans don't interact with people who have physical differences. There's still a distance between persons with disabilities and those without, he says. He tells me that he hopes the Paralympics can help narrow that distance he still feels.
이 소리면 되나요? 오케이.
A pair of skis rest against the wall of Paralympian Yuen Sheik's workshop. On weekends, he still heads out to the mountains. Yu says after all these years, he no longer thinks the Paralympics can really change perceptions, but in some way, that's okay. He says he feels attitudes towards persons with disabilities in Korea have improved, even without the games. He says, when I ski now, people cheer me on and clap for me. They tell me how good I am. I feel I'm really treated equally now. I still get looks, but I think it's because they admire what I'm doing. Yu adds now, when he leaves his prosthetic leg behind, he doesn't have to wrap it up in a plastic bag anymore. For the World, Jason Strother, Seoul.
Those new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, President Trump says he's defending America's national security with them.
A strong steel and aluminum industry are vital to our national security. Absolutely vital. Steel is steel. You don't have steel, you don't have a country. Our industries have been targeted for years and years, decades, in fact, by unfair foreign trade practices leading to the shuttered plants and mills, the laying off of millions of workers, and the decimation of entire communities. And that's going to stop, right? It's going to stop.
Specifically, Trump wants to stop other nations like China from dumping cheaper state-subsidized steel and aluminum here in the U.S. Many who work in the American steel industry are cheering the president's move. Others are worried about the consequences. The Economist, for example, warns the new tariffs put the global trade system in grave danger. Its latest cover even features a cartoon of Trump's face as an orange hand grenade. David Rennie is Washington bureau chief for The Economist. David, is there a pin in that grenade or is it already out?
It is perilously close to being out. And it's because of the weapon that he has chosen, this argument about national security. And that's what really concerns us. It's not that he has passed a tariff that is so large and will affect so much foreign steel and aluminium that it will transform the American economy. Actually, the truth is, it's not actually going to cost that much money. But the symbolism of the choice that he's made to use this national security argument is really, really worrying.
So why do you see these tariffs as a grave danger in practice, not just symbolism?
Because here's the thing. So after World War II, you had a rules-based order that was built under American tutelage that took in America's allies around the world. And one core element of that was the idea that might doesn't equal right when it comes to trade, that the world suffers when you have tit-for-tat retaliation, that it is better for countries to let each other trade. And if you catch someone cheating by unfair subsidies or selling something below cost price, what the lawyers call dumping, then you're allowed to go to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and say, I want to put up a barrier against these unfair practices. And the truth is, when Donald Trump talks about China hollowing out the American steel industry, talks in sort of lyrical dystopian terms about all those millions of people laid off, he's really making a complaint about globalization. And the odd thing there is that actually most Chinese steel that enters the US market is already covered by protective tariffs, partly because of those protective tariffs based on a legal case that China cheats. China isn't actually a very big steel exporter to the US. China is way down the list of countries that sell steel to the US. So why is Donald Trump talking about national security as well as globalization in the same breath? Well, what he's really doing is he is choosing an incredibly powerful weapon in the kind of trade toolbox, which is this national security claim. So, you know, trade disputes are meant to work a bit like legal disputes. They have courts, they have judges, you go with lawyers and you say, this country is cheating and here's my proof. But there is a kind of nuclear button that a government can push marked national security. And if you say, we cannot be expected to rely on country X for imports as something that is vital to our national security, maybe some special steel for an aeroplane or something, then basically you can override all of the usual trade rules and just say, I have to do this and you can't stop me. Well, that's the button that Donald Trump is threatening to push. His legal justification for these new tariffs on steel and aluminium is an obscure part of a 1962 American law and another obscure part of WTO law that's basically the national security button. And that's what he's pushed, this emergency button. But it's totally bogus. There is no national security case when the major supplier of steel to the US is Canada. And Canada, you know, may be a threat in terms of ice hockey, but it's not a national security threat.
So he uses this bogus argument, but just to play devil's advocate, why would it be a bad thing if Trump blows up the world trading system, this post-war rule system, if it's not working for everyone? I mean, there are progressives who also see tariffs as a tool to rectify economic inequality.
So there's two important questions in that. One is, should we have a gigantic trade war that tries to reverse globalization? So sure, there are lots of progressive, lots of people who voted, you know, for Bernie Sanders in the primaries in 2016, who would love to have exactly that kind of trade war. That's not the claim that Donald Trump is making. Now, The Economist magazine would love to have a big, long argument with exactly those people about the fact that really trade wars always end up costing jobs, make countries poorer, make the world poorer. I can have that argument. But even before you get there, why we put Donald Trump as a hand grenade on our cover is that before you get to a giant argument about globalization, he has pushed a button marked national security, which by pushing it, you know, next it could be India, next it could be China saying, oh, well, if everyone's allowed to push that button, then we're going to declare that this bit of trade is national security. And then the entire rules-based order, so painstakingly constructed after World War II by countries like America, is in real danger.
My mind turns to that photograph of the steel workers in the Oval Office this week and the Trump cabinet on the right side, just kind of real kind of dichotomy of class. What about those steel workers who've been laid off or steel plants here in the U.S. running way under capacity? Don't they deserve a break?
They do. But if you're worried about blue collar workers and how they make a living for themselves in a world of global competition, which is a serious thing and we should worry about it, look at the numbers. I mean, the steel industry employs many, many fewer people than industries in America that use steel, that use aluminium. And, you know, yes, that was a great photo op to have those workers in there. And I'm sure that if you work in a steel mill, it's a real thing that people like me should take seriously, that they could refire, you know, fire up their blast furnace. That's a big thing. But there's maybe 10 times more workers in America who use steel from all over the world to do stuff like make American trucks or use aluminium to make beer cans. And they could lose their jobs or see their, you know, their companies take a real downturn if there's a trade war that makes everything more expensive.
So, David, on many things, Trump has had harsh rhetoric, and then his actions can be much milder. For example, he's also dangled exceptions for some countries on this. Could this be the case with this tariff business?
It could, but that wouldn't make us any less anxious because, you know, either the town police chief always applies the law according to the letter of the law, or the town police chief says, you know what, actually, I'm a bit more like a mafia boss, and if you cross me, I'll come after you with this law. You know, I'll make up some trump up some charge and arrest you. And, you know, the fact that the police chief then says, you know, if you do a favor for me on something else, then I won't do that to you. That, you know, you've broken the basic idea that the rules are rules and that's how big grown-up governments behave. So the fact that he's offering an exemption to Canada and Mexico and says out loud at that photo op that it's so that he can get a deal with them on something like NAFTA, that if Canada and Mexico cuts his negotiators a sweet deal on dairy trade in the NAFTA negotiations, then he won't slap a tariff on them over aluminium and steel for national security. That's terrifying because he's basically saying the rules mean nothing and this wasn't ever about national security. It was just a power play.
David Rennie is Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for us today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman, wishing you a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.